I wanted to go back to something David mentioned, and it's about those photovoltaics. Josh mentioned that this region, this part particularly of Texas, is right in the wheelhouse of the wind energy because of the winds that are produced here. Yeah, are there special geographic terrain that makes the photovoltaic particularly viable? And if so, is it here? Where is it?
You know, the maps I've seen, it gets better the farther west you go. I mean, we're in a good spot here, but you get into New Mexico, the resource is even stronger there.
Yeah.
And that's basically where most of our solar has been developed that we're buying at this point. Not to say we wouldn't have great resources. In fact, our Minnesota company has a lot of solar in Minnesota. You wouldn't think of it being a especially sunny place, but it's definitely stronger the farther west you get.
Yeah, I think the further south, too.
Yeah.
It gets... You get better angles with the sun and longer days. But as far as space goes, I mean, we've got the space. We've got it for wind. We've got the wind resource. We have the solar resource. We have both of those right here. The issue is then moving all that amount of power, because it can't all be consumed right in this region. We don't have the population here. So being able to move the power further east, because we're part of the Eastern Interconnect. There's three main interconnects in the United States, and we're part of, our generators are synced up with New York City, whether that's good or bad, but you know, it's one big machine on the eastern half of the United States, and we're part of that. So we have to move energy to the east, but also at times when it's cheaper east, we bring it this way to save our customers money.
How is that decided? Where is there someone in central control that's keeping an eye on that and moving the directions? Tell me about that.
Well, for us, it's the Southwest Power Pool. And so being in the Eastern Interconnect, as he said, there are all these regional transmission organizations. Then we're a member of the Southwest Power Pool, and it's up to, what, eight or 10 states now, I believe.
Yeah, it goes all the way up to North Dakota.
It's a wide swath.
All the way down to Texas, yeah. New Mexico. But it operates a power market. So every day we're bidding in prices for the next day by hourly intervals. And then also there's a real-time market where, so basically things change, you know, as we all know, things break. So if a power plant somewhere in Kansas breaks, we're able to send power that way, but the prices change because mm-hmm. now, you know, so it's all part of an integrated marketplace now.
You know, at one time we were actually just sort of an island in this part of the world. And that's the way utility business grew up, is each little town at one time was its own little grid. And then we began to connect these little towns with transmission lines, and you begin to see a central utility. But really, up until, what, the 80s or 90s, we were very isolated in this part of the world, just a couple of connections, I guess, back to the east. And so that's made a huge difference for us. And that's something I've had to try to explain to folks, is why are transmission lines so important? Because they cost a lot of money. When we build them, we have to often increase our rates because it brings a lot of cost on. But they're actually making our cost cheaper over the long term because we're able to tap into this wider market now. So we have great import capabilities that we didn't have before. And it's very similar to, you know, an interstate highway system. When we build new roads, we open markets up and goods and services become cheaper. And so that's been just a recent change for us, really. I think 2014, if I'm thinking right, is when we joined the integrated market, about the time we completed some of these new transmission links. So it's been a really interesting thing to try to explain, too.
And it's secure, right? It's more and more secure. And
oh yes, we're spending. That's a whole other topic, you know, in terms of what we have to look at investing in, protecting our system and new upgrades and just communications. We're actually, our lines communicate to us. In fact, a lot of folks here in Amarillo had one more set of cones last week. I think we blocked a few lanes up out on 45th. We were adding some fiber optic to our lines there. So we're investing a lot into kind of the grid of the future. You know, how do you protect it and help it to do its job and give us more information so we know when something's wrong?
So there's the Southwest Power Pool is based out of Little Rock. So they control it, but really, the main control is being done here in Amarillo at our control center. And it's a transmission control center where we control, you know, 20 power units, all these wind farms, But we have 490 substations all the way from Holcomb, Kansas, all the way down to Carlsbad, New Mexico. And so they're watching everything instantly because, you know, as Josh teaches his students, electricity travels at the speed of light. And when something goes wrong, usually you find out within a fraction of a second afterwards. But you're trying to control the grid, but it's become so much more advanced and intelligent with computers and everything else. It's fascinating.
But your staff, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, somebody was working on Thanksgiving holidays,
exactly.
Keeping an eye on that.
Yeah.
Even though there's computer technology, you still need a set, or I presume several sets of eyes on all of this, right? Josh, let me ask you a question. You're at West Texas A&M, and you've been there 4 years.
Yes,
what,
sir.
What was the thing that got you interested in the energy industry?
Texas Panhandle, I would say, is a corridor for the wind project in the entire United States, because Texas is the leader in wind production. Especially this High Plains is the best for wind production, and I think Texas Panhandle can be a role model for the entire country of how you can operate high penetration of wind power into the grid system alongside with the solar power and all those stuff. And we also have several resources that other places not necessarily have, because we are low in population, but we are high in production, but we have a very high integrated system that we were able to move our power either north or even to Dallas or even down to Houston very effectively and supply the needs of those people with renewable energy production, which is zero pollution, which is a big deal, I would say. That is one of the things that interested me to come to West Texas. And also, we had a unique opportunity to develop a hydrogen storage system and test it in order to support the renewables. And I was extremely interested in the project. So next thing I know, I was in West Texas.
It's a great story.
Yeah, great. So tell me some more. What were the factors that made this integration of all these energy sources so seamless here in West Texas? I mean, what were the factors that led to that?
The main factor is we are a Class 4 wind region, which really provided us enough opportunity to put a lot of wind turbines. And also, initially, what people did is they put wind turbines in one of the windiest regions where the high wind is really high. But what they learned eventually is when you put wind turbines in those regions, you eventually damage your wind turbines due to high dependable winds or crosswinds at times. So Texas Panhandle is not like that. It has a unique capability that the wind is pretty constant throughout the year, and we were able to get a high capacity factor, which made the wind industry to bloom in this region. And also West Texas A&M, if I believe, they were doing the research on wind turbines back from 1970s, trying to observe the data and put metadata to see where we can put wind turbines and how this thing can actually grow. And I think those are all the key factors which made Texas Panhandle the wind corridor.
Anything you would add, Wes or David?
I just have to call out Dr. Kenneth Starcher, who you probably know at West Texas. I hope he's listening. He's and Vaughn Nelson, those guys did tons of research on wind, as he said, and when these industries, when the companies came in here, they had all this data that they could, these maps and everything else, and I think that really helped give us a little head start in many ways. But they did a great job for many years.
Yeah, I think an interesting thing is, what is the turbine that you have out on the east side of Canyon now? I've heard it's one of the tallest in North America.
Yes, sir. So we have, since we have all the data, so we partnered with UL Testing Laboratories, and recently they had a contract with Goldwind, and they put one of their tallest wind turbine in the North America in West Texas A&M University to test it, test its prototype and see how it performs. So we have the 3GS turbine, which is capable of producing about 3.8 megawatts during its peak. And it's about, the tower is about 130 meters high, which is about 620 feet. And the whole turbine from tip to bottom is about 653 feet tall, which is the tallest in North America.
Well, you can certainly see it.
Yeah.
From a long way.
I always remind people the tallest building in Amarillo, just down the street here, is about 360 feet, maybe. I can't remember how tall that is. It's about 30, 31 floors. These turbines, even our smaller ones, you know, not talking about this one, they're you put them next to each other, the turbines are going to be taller. Wow. When their blades are up. And so what he's talking about is just massive. And you can see it from I-27, I think I've caught a glimpse of it.
Yes, sir.
It's all easily. The way out on the Nance Ranch, I think, which is east of Canyon. So,
yep.
Pretty amazing. And it's output. What would that be comparable to in terms of other energy generators?
Generally speaking, on an average, it can provide energy for about 1,500 to 2,000 houses. So that's a lot of energy from a single turbine. But we can see a lot of turbines in this, of the same capacity range in Texas Panhandle. Yeah,
we get a lot of questions about that.
Yeah, the higher you get up, the better the wind.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you get more energy out of your investment. And therefore lower cost per kilowatt hour.
What's the shelf life on a tower? I mean, are these things built to be up there for 20 years, 100 years? What do you guess?
Our projects right now are based on a 25-year life. Some of the beginning ones that we entered into contracts with were for 15 years. One by White Deer is an instance of that. That was the very first wind farm we had on our system, which is just northeast of Amarillo. And then we've seen 20 years. I mean, 15, then 20, and now we're at 25 years.
And by contrast, the White Deer facility, I think those are 1 megawatt. Turbines. What we're building now near Plainview are 2 megawatt turbines, and he's talking about one that's almost between three and four. I mean, the turbine size they're larger, and it takes a bigger tower, of course, as he said. But I think that's where we're going to see. They're trying to push the envelope and how big of a turbine you can get up there, how big the blades can be, and obviously there's some limit. It's somewhere along the way, but it's what's helping drive that cost of operation down over time.
I have noticed the blades on the ground, not by accident, by the way, but as a sitting in a facility and in a place I regularly go by, and I never fail to be amazed at the size of those blades, because those are impressive structures when you're on the highway and you're looking, you know, 200 feet away or 500 feet away, but on the ground they're massive. It's just massive.
You know, somewhere I have my little bag of tricks here. If I can't hardly read it, but I want to say how many feet those. Well, now I can't see it. 80 to 90 feet, I think. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, I mean, they're just exceptionally long.
Yeah,
they're made out of fiberglass, which is interesting because we have a fiberglass manufacturer right here in Amarillo. So I mean, it just shows you how small sometimes these economies can be.
Well, that's a great segue to sort of go into something that I'd like to hear from all of you. All three of you about, and that is the idea of if there wasn't the great resources for energy in this region, what would it look like? Have you ever looked at what the economy, and not only the direct economy, you all three are employed in some way or another, but the multiplier effect, right? The cultural life and the life that you spend that's built up by this. I mean, what would this region look
there,
like?
There are parts of the West you go where it's primarily ranching, and I think that's what we would be mostly. You know, if we hadn't learned how to extract water for crops, it's pretty dry most of the time. We've had success with dry land farming. There wouldn't be nearly as many people. Not that we're that overly populated now, but you wouldn't see a city of Amarillo, 200,000 people, out here in the middle of the plains. I really don't believe. And it's brought people in, it's brought industry in, and as you said, it multiplies. And it's brought all these other things. We have hospitals and research institutions, things that would not have been here. So, but I think when I travel out west, sometimes I imagine what would Amarillo have looked like 120 years ago. It was a little kind of a cow town, basically. Mm-hmm. And we still are at heart, but it's
nothing wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that at all, but it just doesn't bring a lot of people with it, usually. And I think we'd be a far less populated area than we are.
David, any other thoughts on that in terms of the economic impact of this industry in the region?
Well, it's huge. I mean, if you think about it, agriculture depends on energy because they are pumping up water for irrigation. There's not much natural rainfall in this area for crops, especially the crops that they're growing. And we have a very large now beef and dairy industry within our region, and then all the transportation. But we, this region is blessed because of the natural resources that we have, the wind, the oil, the gas, and then the solar, you know, for the long term. You know, that's XL Energy's vision, is we're going to be relying more and more on solar and wind. We'll still be using natural gas. I do think there'll be a time when we're ramping off of coal, whether it's just based on pure economics, because gas is getting to be so cheap because it's just a byproduct of oil production. So we are blessed in this region. I think our biggest concern XL Energy has is just the groundwater out of the Ogallala Aquifer. There are certain areas that we're seeing that it's getting pretty thin, and so we're concerned about that and what does that have, you know, impacts that has on the macro economy within that those areas, and then therefore the energy usage.
Very good. Josh, what are your thoughts on the economic impact?
So in general, wind industry alone has created about 24,000 jobs in Texas. And predominantly in this region, it has created a lot of jobs, not only wind energy, also the oil and gas, all the fracking has created a lot of job opportunities, specifically about Texas Panhandle. So recently I visited one of the wind turbine tower manufacturer, and these companies are based in Germany and France, but they are moving their production facility into Amarillo so that they can produce locally, so that they can supply all the needs, because we have so much demand for all the towers and all those things, and that's creating new jobs and bringing back the industries back to Texas Panhandle region, which I think is very unique. And also, one of the things that the WT provides advice for all the farmers is diversify your investment in different fields. And wind industry has created a potential opportunity for them, because they can put a wind turbine in that and still continue their farming. And that would provide them an additional income, even though if the farming is not reliable at certain times. So I think it has created wonderful opportunities for people in Texas Panhandle.
This is HPPR Connect, and this is our community conversations, the very first of our series of three that we're conducting this week. And it's all part of our membership campaign. We're seeking support from listeners out there to support public radio on the High Plains. My suggestion would be to call 1-800-678-7444 or go online to hppr.org. You'll see a red button there. You can click it and lend your support. Join the community of listeners here on the High Plains as HPPR Connect does what it was established to do, and that is to provide reliable, important, contextual information for listeners on the High Plains. So please call 1-800-678-7444 or go online, hppr.org. If you have a question, if you'd like to make a comment or have a question about our guest, please feel free to call that number, 1-800-678-7444, and it'll be passed on to me. Let me stop there and mention our guests are David Hudson and Wes Reeves from XL Energy, and then also Dr. Joshua Parthipan of West Texas A&M. One of the things that I want to bounce off of something that you just said, Josh, and that is about students who are interested in this industry. What would you tell a young person, or even a person who is not quite so young, but looking to make a career out of working in the energy industry? What would your advice be?
So West Texas A&M objective is basically to cater to the students who are locally in this region to provide workforce for all the companies that are in and around Texas Panhandle. So we have about 7 graduate programs. Some of the key programs that support the energy field is mechanical engineering, environmental science engineering, sometimes even computer science and mathematics. And we also have a brand new electrical engineering, especially to cater these specific needs towards the energy sector. Because we felt that there is a big need for electrical engineers for the future in this region, because there's a big boom in wind and even in all the energy sectors. So we created one energy electrical engineering, which is predominantly focused on energy. And also we have a master's program. Let's say if people are working in industry and they have a bachelor's program, not necessarily in engineering, but any other field, but they're working, but their work experience is closely related to engineering, then we admit those students to master's program so that we can talk a lot about engineering and especially energy and all those different fields to educate them and prepare them for the future, because we believe they are the future. If we spread the word and educate the young generation, they can change the world, especially Texas Panhandle.
David, how many employees does XL have in this region?
Okay, well, just in Amarillo, we have about 1,000, and many of these are engineers. And but in Texas and New Mexico, we have about 1,500 employees. That goes all the way from meter readers, linemen, substation technicians. But if you think about it, we have about 24,000 miles of line in a 50,000 square mile area. And literally, it's like a printed circuit board. It's just our printed circuit board covers 50,000 square miles. We design it, engineer it out of our Amarillo headquarters. We have a lot of engineers that are in different service centers, whether it's Hobbs or Carlsbad, Roswell, Perryton, Plainview, Canyon, Hereford, I mean, all over. And what they're doing is they're working on connecting new customers, and we have to design it, make sure that the system is adequate to supply their needs. And it's very technical in nature. You know, it's very specific. You know, it's very precise service that we provide, electric power at 60 hertz at a specific voltage. And so we hire quite a few technical people. I'm very, very proud of our workforce. But one thing that we've always been excited about is West Texas A&M's engineering program. It's sometimes very difficult to recruit specialized engineers to this region. And so we always have found it better to have homegrown. And that's what WT students are. They are homegrown from this region. They want to stay in this region. And so we had a lot of success with their mechanical engineering. We were hiring them left and right, and now we're really excited about their double E or electrical engineering program with an emphasis on power, because that's what all this is dealing with, is power, is not little circuits, but big power applications.
Well, Wes, you're speaking of someone who started in another field and then transitioned into working for an energy company. I mean, what is your advice to anyone out there?
You know, I get called a lot about jobs, and we're still one of those places that people where they want to work, and I feel good about that. We're a top employer. We have good benefits. People tend to stay here for a long time, and so, you know, you don't always have to have certain levels of education. One thing we talk a lot about are field personnel, our linemen. You can be an 18-year-old high school graduate and get on as a lineman apprentice and be making $50,000 a year, not counting your overtime. And that number always kind of blows people away. And, you know, you have to pass a few tests and things like that before you get accepted. And obviously we have to have a job for you. But that's a great program. And so we're bringing on young people for a 4-year apprenticeship program. At the end of that 4 years, they earn their journeyman status certificate, which they can use anywhere in the country. It's almost like a college degree that they're earning while they're working. And a lot of these young people are going to school while they're doing this, because our company pays up to around 80% of their tuition. So we've got this great program out there, and we talk about it a lot. Yeah. We're like a college in many ways, but we're also providing a valuable service. So that's something I was talking about. I myself, with a journalism degree, I would have been worthless, you know, doing that. But, you know, just ask David. But there's a lot of But there are a lot of young people. This is they're really cut out for this kind of work, and they would love it.
So do you do that through job fairs or do recruiting in other ways?
We have full-time recruiters here in Amarillo, and they're on the road about as much as you are probably, and they crisscross the plains, and they go to a lot of – they even go down to the high school level, because one thing we decided, we got to reach these kids in high school when they're making their choices for college. So we're promoting local universities and getting them excited about coming back, getting their education, coming back home. And I believe it's paying off. I don't have any great numbers here to show you that, but we have a lot of young people now working in our downtown office building, and a lot of them grew up in these little towns, and a lot of them are WT graduates. So I think we're beginning to see a lot of this success that we've been hoping for.
Well, one of the things I think a recurring theme that we've had over this first 45 minutes or so is something that I think if you were removed from this region or hadn't really thought about it, you might not consider it, but it is the idea that even though we live in a sort of a zero-sum gain world, that's not how energy, that's not it. It's going to be a balanced diet, if you will, of oil and gas, and as David has mentioned, solar and other ways. I mean, there was at some point the talk of the end of oil, right? Maybe it had hit its peak, and this was it. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore, and it's because of technology advances in extraction, right?
That's true, and we serve a large part of the Permian Basin, that's farther south in our New Mexico territory, and we're told the drilling will continue down there for decades and decades because of the layers of potential they have there. So I forget, David may remember the number of wells they think can be dug, drilled in that part of the world. It's just phenomenal, and this will take decades.
That's right, and they've always known the oil is in the Delaware Basin, which is a basin that is in southeast New Mexico that crosses over into West Texas. But with fracking, they know how to get to it, and they're bringing up natural gas with it. When I started in this industry in 1984, it was just after Congress had passed in 1978 the Energy Use Act, or Fuel Use Act. And if you remember that was when Jimmy Carter was president, and they actually banned the use of natural gas in boilers because they said we're getting ready to run out of natural gas. And now we have so much natural gas. It's because of technology and how to get it out of the ground that we're going to be exporting natural gas. We're exporting oil, and it's totally revolutionized the U.S. economy, like I talked about initially. So there's a lot of exciting things. In the meantime, we are going to have environmental issues that we're going to have to be concerned about. I mean, when you start seeing big oil companies coming out with sustainability goals, you know, you've got Exxon, you've got other people that are getting a lot of pressure on them by investors to be doing something. And so it's gonna require a big hybrid mix of different types of resources, and that's exactly what we have here in the High Plains.
I have a question. We have a question from a listener. Eric from Amarillo asked, specifically to our representatives from XL, as wind energy and solar power continues to become more accessible, does XL have any plans to adjust the buyback policy to continue to make renewable energy more affordable? And maybe we should start with talking about what is the buyback policy for our listeners and then go from there.
And that's more of a regulatory issue in terms of, I think he's probably referring to maybe it's say rooftop solar or something like that. So, and each state is really different how they do that. And we're regulated by our state commission. So, and I'd have to go back over the policy in my mind here in Texas, but we do take surplus power. So if you're generating with rooftop solar, you've got kind of two choices with us here in Texas. Depending on the type of meter we install, you can return some back to us, but there is a monthly charge on that. So there's been a lot of discussion on how do you make that fair for everyone, because you have a lot of customers who aren't putting rooftop solar on. And so we all have to contribute our share to the central grid. We're all depending on that central grid. And so it's been a real regulatory issue, I think, over the years. That continues to change. David could probably speak to a little bit more about that.
But. Yeah, this is always a big debate. It's called net metering. It's where customers get paid for their excess energy. Sometimes they feel like they should be reimbursed at their full rate. Well, their full rate includes transmission lines, distribution lines. Well, they're really not avoiding all of those. In fact, like rooftop solar, it requires a constant voltage source from the grid. So it gets down to what do you credit back to the customer? And there's a big argument that they should not be credited back for the wires, because those wires are going to be there whether the sun's shining or not. And if they're not paying for it, that means somebody else is. Their neighbor who doesn't have solar on the roof is going to be picking up their share. So that's the whole issue. There's big debates on it, especially in the solar community for rooftop solar. I think, you know, as the cost of photovoltaics comes down, it'll be more competitive, but actually large-scale solar, like our 140-megawatt project, where you get the economies of scale of putting so much in one place, it's going to cost half of what a rooftop solar project costs.
Wow.
It's just because of economies of scale. Because if you think about it, you got to go put a few solar panels on every roof. It costs a lot of money to do that. So that's the debate that's out there. Arizona's gone through a big debate on net metering, and it basically gets down to is somebody subsidizing somebody else.
And just to clarify, the regulatory agency in the state of Texas is the Railroad Commission. Is that right?
For us, it's the Public Utility Commission of Texas, and Railroad Commission regulates natural gas companies. And so, yeah, that's a little bit different here. And in New Mexico, we have the New Mexico Public Regulation Commission. And then we're also regulated by the federal government and many other ways too. But because we're an interstate company, so we buy and sell electricity across state lines. So FERC is also a regulator.
Okay. Well, you know, the idea of this balance of energy sources is, as I said, it's something I don't think people consider much. But what's in the ascendancy, and then what are the things? David mentioned coal is something that's probably going to become a smaller part. Where will this look like in 20 years in terms of the leading provider, and then what would be next and next and next? I mean, Josh, why don't you tell us what you think there?
Well, one of the uniqueness of electrical power industry is, in all the other industries, you produce, and there's always a consumer. But here, you're catering the demand, and you're basing on your demand, you're producing electricity. When someone flips the switch, they're expecting that the light needs to go on. They don't care who's producing it. But on our end, someone needs to produce instantly in order to provide their needs. So in olden days, we have what we call baseload power plants, like coal power plants and nuclear power plants, which were producing and supplying the needs. And we have gas turbine power plants, which are producing the peak needs. Now we have a lot of renewable energy kicks in, and we don't have actual control over it because they depend on how the wind blows and how the sun shines. So we have to kind of accommodate it. And coal power plants are not necessarily designed for it because they cannot ramp up and down because they are large size engines and not necessarily built for ramping up and down. So that's why natural gas is plays a key role in substituting some of the coal power plants and taking up some of the RAMs and old generation and all those things, and at the same time keeping the grid more reliable in nature. One of the things that WT is involved in is how energy storage can also solve the problem in order to make the grid more reliable and more greener in nature. We have investigated several energy storage systems, even in large scale, small scale. One of the things that we are currently doing is with battery storage for homes and off-grid systems. And also for a large scale, we are developing hydrogen gas turbines, which makes it more efficient and cost-effective because storage is expensive. But we are trying to do continuous research in order to bring down the cost of a hydrogen gas turbine power plant that it can compete with a gas turbine power plant.
Well, we're nearing the very end of our time, but what I wanted to do is offer each of our guests a moment or two to sort of wrap up. What is the takeaway? What is the thing? David Hudson from XL Energy. Let me start with you. I mean, what should listeners take away from this conversation and from the topic of the future of the energy industry in our region?
Yeah, I think we will continue to see, as Josh talked about, increased diversity. We'll see increased use of renewables. I think in the long run, when you talk about 20 years, coal will pretty much be out. And it's just mainly because the cost of controlling the emissions on coal is not cost effective given the cost of natural gas now and renewables. A lot of it's going to be a function of environmental policies in the long run. And the whole debate on global warming. And I think Josh is right on storage. We're going to see more and more emphasis placed on energy storage, whether it's batteries or hydrogen or other means. But the cost is going to have to come down a great deal for it to be really cost effective. I think our medium-term plan is energy is going to be very affordable. It's not going to be going up more than the price of inflation. So I think there's a bright outlook for this region on energy, and it takes jobs to produce all of this energy.
Wes, final thoughts?
You know, just real quickly, we can kind of predict what we think is going to happen in 10 or 20 years, but then I look back over the last 10 or 20 years, and I realize some things happened that we didn't expect to happen. When David was talking about natural gas becoming so abundant, we didn't see that 15 years ago. And a lot of this is because of innovation. And so I think our energy industry attracts innovators. And so I like to hope there's a surprise out there somewhere, that somebody comes up with something that's going to change everything. And I think that's why I'd encourage young people to look at this field.
There's probably sitting in your classroom right now, hopefully. Josh.
Absolutely, sir.
With a giant brain, they're going to blow us away in 20 years. Give us in about 30 seconds, what's your takeaway from this?
So my takeaway is WT is really participating in a lot of things. And I encourage students to participate in all these activities and be a part of the future, especially in terms of energy, because that is a key driver for economy in and around this region. Contact us if you want to come and visit us. Please do visit us and feel free to email any of the faculty that you're interested in to get more information about what we do and how we do it.
Well, I'd like to thank all three of you for this conversation. I feel like our listeners have been well served by the information that you've provided. As I said, this is the first of our community conversations that we're conducting this week. Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, I'm sure you guys will all come back in and just sit in and watch us, but tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, we'll be having a conversation on education and specifically higher education in this region. So don't miss that. Call 1-800-678-7444 or go online to hppr.org to make your contribution to support HPPR Connect and join your listener supporters on the High Plains.